Happy New Year. Welcome to the Diversity Remix, only provocative conversations at the intersection of business, politics, and culture. I'm Charlie Echeverry.
And I'm Jesus Chavez.
This week's episode, A More Perfect Union. In today's deep dive, what's the upside and downside for the world of tech and the business of innovation when labor groups band together to demand change? Is it growth and prosperity or red tape and bureaucracy? And in our Courage or Cringe segment, Monday Night Football, Coinbase, and Kamala Harris. Are former NFL players turned commentators, fonts of prophetic wisdom and meant to be respected? Or are they out-of-touch talking heads who detract rather than edify? Is diversity and inclusion a PR effort for Silicon-based tech companies? Or are they actually practicing what they preach? And is our VP-elect's recent comments about her childhood, which are eerily reminiscent to MLK's, an example of harmless coincidence or cynical plagiarism? This and other controversial topics on this episode of TDR. Happy New Year, Jesus.
Happy New Year, Charlie.
We took a week off there, very well deserved. How'd you close out the end of the year?
It was good. It was nice to, I think, you know, shared it with you. Went out. I was outside a lot, like being outside, in a very COVID safe way, just to be clear. Mm-hmm. Got a chance to go to Joshua Tree. Never been there before.
Was there a lot of people there?
There was a lot of people actually to get into the park, but yeah. It's a massive park. So yeah. There is plenty of opportunity there to walk around and climb, you know, mm-hmm. rock climbing. It literally looks like someone, they just put it there like by hand. It's just gorgeous.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I got a chance to do a lot of outdoor activities in general. So I was pretty happy about that.
Very cool. We went out to the snow. There's a place called Fraser Mountain, about an hour and change north of here on the 5. And it's not like it's an organized snow thing. It's literally like, you know, old school, poor version of poor man's snow. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pull off to the side of the road. You get one of those little plastic sleds and just go down the hill.
That sounds awesome.
It was nice. It was actually nice, but it was good to get out. And we've had that tradition for a number of years. But anyway, we're on the other side of 2020. We're now looking at 2021. Never thought the day would come. You were very cynical about the potential midnight to literally never come on 2020.
There was literally like a massive storm like 2 days before the end
That's
of the
true.
Year.
That's true. In LA, like 5 inches of rain. Yeah.
There was parts of LA that even got hail. I don't know if you saw that. Yeah. So you have a family that lives in this area where they actually got hail. So I was very skeptical that we were going to make it. So, we did it though. So we'll see. We'll see if 2021 is going to be better. Hopefully it will be.
I know we closed out last year with our kind of 2020 retrospective, but any 2021, commitments or what do you call them? What do they call them? Intentions, New Year's, resolutions.
Resolutions.
You can tell how often I make them that I don't even know what they're called.
Honestly, I'm not a fan of resolutions.
Okay.
And the reason for that is I feel that if something that I want to do, I mm-hmm. just need to just do it.
Nice.
So I've done it before. Like I've used them, you know, effectively where I think 1 year I did the, I'm going to get in better shape. And it was around, I actually started before. That's usually what happens to me. It always starts before mm-hmm. the actual end of the year. So it never actually happens in the actual new year directly because the moment kind of gets in my head, I want to start doing it.
But you're pretty in shape now.
I would say that there's the one that I do have is, which with my daughter and I, we agree that we're going to do, or that I'm going to do a marathon, which I've never done.
Oh, really?
Surprisingly enough, I've never done that.
Wait, you've never done because you've done a triathlon.
I've done multiple triathlons. Yeah.
Isn't that harder than a marathon?
It depends. If you just like running for a really long time, you know, no.
Right.
So I've done multiple half Ironmans, but I've never done a marathon. So my daughter and I have decided to start training together. She's 8 years old. She basically rides her bike while I run.
Nice.
So we just started doing that.
So the idea would be that she would actually bike ride 26.2 and you would run it.
Well, the idea is she's going to train with me for the marathon. So the actual day of the race itself, she won't be able to participate.
Oh, okay.
But that she'll actually do all the training with me leading up to the race.
But when you actually train for a marathon, do you actually end up running a marathon before the marathon or no?
No, you never get that. I think the longest distance, maybe like 20 miles or 21 miles around there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, even for any of the races that I did as the half Ironmans, on the half Ironman, you do a half a marathon, mm-hmm. which is 13.1 miles. I think the longest I ran was maybe 11 miles, or I may have gone to 12.
That seems like a lot.
Yeah, but you never do the full distance.
11 is the most I've ever run in my entire life in one, series or exercise or sequence.
And that was at the height of my running ability. Now I'm pretty in shape, but I'm not, I've just never been a runner. Yeah. I do have some intentions for the year. I don't know if you'd call them resolutions, but I've got three, and they're of course as is my style, I've made them all alliterative. So they all start with the letter C. It's courage, clarity, and communication. Those are my three things that I'm going to have as intentions this year.
I like that. Now, how do you see those being reflected in action? Yeah.
I think it's all kind of related to the same thing, right? Courage of like saying things as I believe them to be and being vocal about it. You know what I mean? Just calling it like I see it. Clarity with, and particularly in the work that we do, you know, being more intentional about being clear and prescriptive as opposed to descriptive, which I have more of a tendency to be. As you know, famously on this podcast, you know, where it may not be right, but it sounds awesome. Like that's the opposite of what I'm trying to do.
It always sounds awesome.
Clarity. And then the last one, communication, because, and that's more of a personal thing with my family and my wife, just about being more communicative and sharing more about the things that go on in my day. So those are my three things.
I think those are great.
I think we can actually get started with a few of those just now. We're seems like we're kind of picking on Google again with our deep dive, but it's an interesting topic.
Just lots to pick
on. It sounded a little bit dry when we first started talking about it, but there's actually a story there that I think is actually pretty interesting. So where shall we begin?
Let's start with the main and most recent item that came up around Google. So the New York Times reported that more than 400 Google engineers and other workers have formed a union called the Alphabet Workers Union. Right now, this group is affiliated with what's called the Communications Workers of America, which is a broader union that represents workers in telecommunications and media in the U.S. and in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this type of union is considered a minority union in that it represents a fraction of the company's more than 260,000 full-time employees and contractors. Now, there's a bunch of issues there in terms of what makes a minority versus a full union. The biggest one is that for a full union, like they actually have to vote for it.
Right.
In the case of minority union, you don't.
But we're using the term minority here, not in the terms of ethnicity. We're using minority in terms of numbers.
Minority in terms of representations of the number of employees, and right? So it's 400 out of, basically, it's a pretty small number, 400 out of 260,000.
And by the way, I remember we talked about Google's employees at one point, and I found a stat that said about 120,000. That must have been Google, not Alphabet.
Well,
maybe that was a difference.
It could be, or it also could be related to, and this is part of the issue here.
Oh, no, it could be the contractors.
The contractors, right? That's the big one, because they use a lot of contractors, right? And that's part of the challenge that you see here. That becomes, you know, part of the problem, right?
Okay.
In any case, the reason why we thought this would be a really interesting topic to talk about is, so let's start with the first one, which is this is highly unusual for Silicon Valley, right? So on the one hand, you know, a lot of us will think of Silicon Valley as being very liberal, but it has not been fertile ground for unions, right?
Whereas normally liberal environments tend to be receptive to unionization.
Yeah, I think people tend to...
Or associate them with it.
Right. Yeah. In broad strokes, if we talk about people that are liberal, you're going to be, you know, maybe more pro-employee, that sort of thing. But in the case of Silicon Valley, it actually hasn't been. Now, what's interesting is the why, right? Now, one of the reasons why is that for many tech workers, they actually haven't been very interested in unions, right? And part of it is because they don't face the same kind of issues that most unions tend to focus on, which is wages, right? That's not really a big concern for most of these tech workers who tend to be like really well paid. And then secondly is that they many times don't feel that these same unions are not really equipped to address the concern that some of these tech employees actually have, which is more about ethics and the role that technology more broadly sort of plays within society, right? So that's a really interesting
It's super
sort of
interesting. I mean, is that a first time maybe ever in the history of unionization that that's been the core complaint rather than, that's you know, safe environment, wages, exactly. Benefits, things like that?
Yeah, I think so, right? Because at
collective
least,
bargaining.
Historically, the reason you would have union is to basically be able to protect employees from management and protect them in terms of pay is a big one, work conditions.
It's a negotiating leverage, though, is what it is.
It is. But in the case of the tech industry, Silicon Valley, individual employees tend to have a lot of leverage, especially those that are highly skilled, right? As a matter of fact, it's super competitive, right? The more sort of skilled those engineers are, the more they're being sort of pushed from one place to the other. So in general, that balance of power, at least in my opinion, has been much more balanced in the sense that when you have a strong engineer, these companies try to do whatever they can to retain them.
Yeah,
that's why you have many of these companies have so many sort of benefits that they have associated, you know, for their employees. But there, it also starts to, you know, bring the sort of the broader problem, which is because these employees have been very used to being catered to, right, by their companies, it also now has sort of led to a much broader sort of push in terms of activism. Some of it led, you know, especially over the summer with what happened there. But that's sort of the other really interesting point about this new move to unionization, in this case for Google, is that it is part of a broader trend, right? Part of this is increasing demands by employees at Google for policy overhauls on pay, harassment, and ethics that is basically going to escalate some of those tensions with top leadership. We've seen that already. The most recent example of that, one that we talked about, a few episodes back, which is with Timna Gebru, which is a black woman who is a respected artificial intelligence researcher who in December mentioned that Google had fired her after she criticized the company's approach to minority hiring and the biases built into AI systems. Now, since then, we talked about it the last time, there's been a lot of sort of fallout from that effort. And what she was, basically Google's position at the time was that she had resigned and her position had been fired. And you know, when we talked about it, I think we both agreed, like, look, it could have handled a lot better. And at the end of the day, Google is not going to look good at the end of this thing.
The other thing is that in doing research for this episode, I also came across a number of other instances where people have claimed on all sides of the ideological spectrum that they had been either let go or had their wings clipped or something by Google for too much internal activism, right?
Yeah.
And that episode that we identified the last time with Gebru, the AI researcher, to me, it smelled of that, thorn in your side, too much activism, we're going to figure out a way to clip you. And they probably did, because...
Which is super interesting, right? Yeah. Because on the one hand, you know, I would describe Silicon Valley as being very pro-employee, especially those high-paying employees or high-skilled employees, because of all the benefits and all the sort of the flexibility that is there. At the same time, you sort of see this other side of that coin, which to your point... Where, very pro-employee until, you know, they become a little active, until they start questioning the ethics of the company, until they start trying to rally things up. All of a sudden, like, oh, wait a minute, shut that down. All of a sudden, they sound way more like regular corporate in other places. So I think it's really interesting. Other things, by the way, in terms of Google that they've dealt with is in 2018, more than 20,000 employees staged a walkout to protest how the company had handled sexual harassment. And then others had opposed business decisions that they deem unethical, such as the development of artificial intelligence for the Defense Department and providing technology to Customs and Border Protection. So in these cases, you saw Google employee directly questioning the decisions of management on how the technology was going to be used, which is a really interesting dynamic of the fact that I think even these employees felt that they had a voice to actually express that. So it speaks to that there was a more balance in power, or at least a more perceived balance in power, where employees really felt that they could actually dictate what Google should or shouldn't do. And I think getting sort of slapped down in these cases has now caused for them to figure out, well, maybe we actually need better protection as employees, and then start looking at a place like unions to provide that kind of protection.
What do you think my big question in going through all of this material was, it was a little bit unclear to me, or a bit blurry, what it is that this union wanted and who they actually were representing, right? So, like, specifically what the goals were. As near as I could find, this Alphabet Workers Union was looking to use all tactics available to them to pressure Google into changing its policies, and use pressure campaigns to basically influence, right, what they called, quote, to protect people who we think are being discriminated against or retaliated against. And I mean, that on the surface, it sounds like one of those things that's so non-controversial, like, who would disagree with that? But then what exactly is the how does a union do that differently than other kind of people ops and HR groups and different things like that? If there's not like a collective bargaining thing, if you're not going to be, trying to demand or request, you know, policy changes or things like that. So I guess my first question is, what is it exactly discreetly that you're looking to do? Who are you looking to do it for? And why does it require an entirely new organization to do it? Those are my three main questions on this. Before we even get into the philosophical issues of unions, which I'm not a fan of, generally speaking.
At least according to this New York Times article that we were researching for this topic, you know, it said that the workers that were involved in this Alphabet Workers Union said that primarily they saw it as an effort to give structure and longevity to activism at Google. So I think a lot of it has to do with them feeling supported to be able to raise issues and having more power than at least what they felt they had in the past, as it relates to many of these issues, whether maybe diversity, you know, sexual harassment, the type of topics that...
So it's almost like formalizing a sounding board is what it sounds like.
I think part of it is that. If I want to read between the lines, what I think this does is the fact that it's... Because it's a sort of in-between step to a full-on union, which I'm sure Google does not want, the threat of even having some version of a union, even if it's considered a minority union of 400 only of the, what are 260,000 employees, I think it starts to move Google in that direction that unless they get their act together and better address the points that these employees are bringing up, right? Even to the call out that happened with Gimbru was let go or whatever, she walked out of the building. You know, now they're in real danger of the rest of their staff saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we should be fully unionized. Maybe we should be having the type of bargaining agreements that you see in other industries. And if that happens, then they're in real trouble. So I think the creation of it alone is a bigger enough threat to put that kind of external pressure to be able to create more lasting change. And frankly, for them to be not to just be ignored or pushed aside, which it sounds there was some elements of that even when we talked about it the last time.
And I guess I buy the idea of formalizing a sounding board because, especially in the case of Google, from what I understand over the last several years, they've actually started to, they wouldn't, I'm sure, classify it as remove the transparency, but they have definitely moved away from the, like, every Friday, all hands, where you can ask the people any question you want and you can get them on the spot and kind of, you know, they've moved away from all that. They've made it like, if you get enough upvotes to your question, we'll ask that one. Like, it's become much more kind of bureaucratic. Sure. So in that world where you are getting your ability to voice your concerns maybe curtailed, maybe it does make sense to kind of formalize a structure that allows you to, you know, you didn't like my word agitate earlier, but it's kind of what it is. It's agitate for change or demand change or request change politely. But so I get that part, like that part I understand. The question of who is it for, I have questions about because, you know, I think about the stated, at least as I could find the goal, the stated goal. This one, the vice chair, I guess, last name was Shaw. I forget his first name. Mm-hmm. But he's the one who said, we're going to use every...
Chewy Shaw is the
Chewy
name.
Chewy Shaw, thank you. We're going to use every tool that we can to use our collective action to protect people who we think are being discriminated against or retaliated against. That sounds like a super noble, worthwhile goal. And I wonder, though, would that apply to James Damore or Kevin Cernicke, guys who were engineers at Google that got fired or resigned or whatever, and who subsequently sued or had complaints mm-hmm. about being marginalized for conservative points of view. Like, does it apply to them? Like, that's just a straight up question.
I would assume so. I mean, yeah. And I think it's interesting, right? Because the problem I think Google is starting to face here is once you start getting from both sides, it's a problem, a massive problem, right? Because on the one hand, not that I'm saying it's okay, but if you could literally just constrained to the issue being with, well, there's only those voices that feel that they're not well represented enough. In this case, we're saying more conservative voices that, look, based on being in Silicon Valley, based on being in California, you're going to say they're probably a smaller percentage of the employees that are there. You could sort of, to some extent, push those to the side. But the problem that now Google has is they're getting on both ends, both the liberal, more leaning side of the organization, which is going to be a much larger share of the employees that are there. And to, you know, to the examples you just brought up, all the right side leaning all feel that they're not being well heard, represented, et cetera. You have a pretty big problem if that's the case.
And by the way, that's a mirror image of what's going on the consumer side of the equation too with these platforms. I mean, both sides are pissed off.
Yeah, and I think all of those things are related. What I find probably most interesting is what I think of the sort of the company journey, right? The structure journey that happens as you look at some of these startups that tend to usually start as very kumbaya.
Oh, yeah.
100% transparency.
Culture.
All about culture. And then you get to a point where now you have a pretty decent sized organization and you get that moment of like where you have to like sort of recheck people like, no, you're actually an employee. No, we have people that make the decision. That's not your call. And it's like that big sort of the point. Look, I've never worked at Google, so I can't speak to what they've gone through. We worked with Google, and I've also worked in organizations that are different stages of that transition. Mm-hmm. I remember having, as a matter of fact, I wasn't there yet, but a company that I was involved with. I remember talking to the previous CEO, and he told me that, you know, in conversation, they would have this like open Q&A for every Friday kind of thing, right? Very, very typical. He said, look, then he started getting really questions that just were not appropriate, like all the time, and he had like literally just stop. Things like, well, how much money do you make? And why do you make that much more than we do? And all of a sudden he was like, whoa, time out.
Pump the brakes, baby.
Yeah. Like, we got to, like, you know, pull this back. So I do find it a little bit hilarious. There's some element of that, right? Of the company kind of growing up and it's much more of a corporation than it is a startup. It hasn't been a startup for a very long time.
Hasn't for a long time. You got more than 250,000 employees and contractors. I mean, it's almost like a small government at some point, less than it is a company. And you have to sort of, at some point, with when you're talking about numbers that big, institute these sort of not friendly to the just kind of creative stream of consciousness perspective.
But I guess go back to a brief comment that you made in talking about this. You mentioned just not being for union.
Like, let's talk about that.
Yeah. Why do you feel that way?
Sure.
How do you feel that sort of applicable in this case for a company like this?
It doesn't seem as applicable because, my image of unions are mostly about worker protections related to pay, standards of, how they actually do their work. The kind of collective bargaining where people are, obviously they don't have the same one-to-one referent power to have a conversation with their management. So they have to get together in a group to be able to force change. So it's different in that sense that it seems like the desire of this organization is more about the kind of ethical things that they want to aspire to. And it's not necessarily about those fundamental things. The reason I'm not philosophically a fan of unions is, on one side, I like the idea of people being able to band together and share their concerns, especially if their concerns are uniform about whatever the issues are, and go to their management and request that change. No problem with that. But the experience that I've had in my time with unions are like the kind of unions like the electricians unions all the names of like the worker types of unions where you're not able to actually do something unless you have the proper person there. You know, the bureaucracy and the red tape
you
that goes along with it.
You see union and sort of
inefficiency. That's how I equate it. So yeah. I see it as a conflict to innovation is kind of what I see. At least in the traditional sense. That's my philosophical beef. Now, I'm not saying in practice I can get behind it depending on what it means. But my philosophical point of view is that if I see a thing that we can pick up off the ground because it's there, but I can't because I'm not the right union guy, and then we have to leave it or walk around it, to me that's the example of inefficiency that doesn't work in the private sector the way that it should.
Yeah, so I could definitely understand that point of view, right? I mean, look, I think in many ways, when I think about unions, my best example was that when I first started at Univision, right? I was traveling a lot with the president of the radio division, and we would go to all the different markets and sort of had a lot of strategy sessions. I remember my first year, within the first few months, we started going to, I guess it wasn't my first year. It was maybe after the first few years, we were going to Puerto Rico. Now, Puerto Rico as a place, as a territory, it tends to be very unionized, right? Like constantly. So I remember, as a matter of fact, even before I started with the company, there was always like some kind of union negotiation going on. One particular year they were there, and actually I was no longer working with radio, I remember. I was working with the television group. We showed up, and then frankly, there was like a protest that was organized knowing that I was coming in with the president of the television group.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A protest,
right? Because it was in the middle of negotiations with the union.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So we showed up early, got to the station. It was like during business planning, right? So we got to the station. We're working through the business plan. And then we hear that there's some big protest outside of the station. And apparently their plan was to protest and to not let us into the building as a way of protest, right?
The union people.
But they showed up too late. Like, we already had
gotten. You're already in.
We were already in. Like, they didn't start it early enough. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe after breakfast, but
it is Puerto Rico, island time.
Yeah, exactly, right? So we thought it was pretty hilarious. But I remember hearing and having this conversation with some of the general managers. I remember someone telling me this. They're like, look, I can understand why people have this sort of bad taste in their mouth as it relates to unions, because there is a certain level of bureaucracy, to you mentioned, inefficiency. He said, to him, it was like the way he described it. Like, but to me, it's like once you agree to what the work is going to be, like then you're just off to the races. Like, it's fine. And I agree with the level of that. And I understand the idea of protecting employees, especially those that don't really have a point to negotiate from. The challenge with agreeing on what you're going to work on is also agreeing on everything else you're not going to work on. And that's, I think, part of what you're talking about, because it creates this dynamic where it's like, that's not my job. That's
exactly what I mean. Job. And even agreeing to the work that's going to be done, how does that work in 2021 a world like the one we live in, where initiatives and job descriptions and organizations can go from A to Z in the course of a quarter?
And I think that's what, for me, is one of the biggest questions with this, which you touched on already, which is as it relates to the tech industry, where innovation is such a critical part of the dynamic, how does unions, at least in the traditional form that they've had, operate in that kind of environment, right? Now, here what we're talking about is a little bit different, right? Maybe this is the new version of what this looks like, right, which is not about, as focused on the working environment, on what the roles they're going to have and responsibilities on the pay, but more about positions that the employees feel very strongly about, that they individually don't feel like they have the leverage to be able to negotiate or push on hard enough with these companies. And that's kind of an interesting dynamic. I mean, to me, like, I'm curious to see how much of this becomes a bigger problem or bigger thing at Google, and how much of that starts to now sort of go into the rest of Silicon Valley and start impacting everybody else.
I think it has major implications, but even before getting out of Google, there's a lot of issues at Google. Think about it. Number one is you have to pay dues for this union just like any other one.
Yeah.
It's a 1% of your total income, right? And they've got 400 and some odd whatever members, but I presume their goal is to add members to that.
Sure.
And what happens, again, going back to my question about who you're representing, what happens if the answer to the question of James Damore, this other guy who got fired for what they claimed were a conservative bias, what happens if they're really not representing them and these guys decide they don't want to pay their union dues because their union doesn't have their perspective in mind?
Sure.
Does that not just create more? Do we now have to have a second minority union to deal with these other issues? Like, do you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, there's possibly, but that still has to be a dynamic that happens everywhere. I mean, in all kinds of unions, I'm sure you have the same issue all the time where you're gonna have certain unions that just don't fully represent all the interests of every one of the employees. And I think it's about trying to find the things that that are most common amongst every.
But
all
what
of them.
Happens if people don't leave the unions and they don't pay their union dues and they're called scabs? There's like a whole subculture.
Sure.
Right. I mean, it brings up a lot of interesting.
But I think that's the case in all cases. I don't know if anything unique about that situation you described here.
Mm-hmm. I do think that it's interesting to have a sounding board as it relates to ethical issues that people have not even necessarily thought of. Like they're developing technology that we may not understand the ethical implications of.
Sure.
So if you don't have a body that basically asks those kind of questions and does it on behalf of the body of employees, like that means that you can leave management up to do just what's expedient or whatever it may be.
Right.
But again, you're operating this, even that question, even that thought process is one where you're really thinking of this thing more as a government than a company. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. So I do think that's part of the challenge that you have here and maybe part of the opportunity of having these kind of organizations, because some of the issues that they are dealing with, some of the technology to your point that they are developing have so many implications that you really need to have that almost a little of a yin and yang to be able to push on and make sure that there's actually some more thought being put into its usage. I think the part that I find really interesting is just a broader move towards more social activism. And the role that that's going to play in the future of these companies. And this is maybe one of the best meaning like most formalized version of how this is now shaping the future of these companies, and I find it super interesting.
I don't think that you can unring the bell. I think there's going to be more of this.
Yeah.
I think that this union will probably grow in prominence. It may spin off into other unions. They'll probably gain more power. And I do think that Google's in a position to your earlier point where like they have to. They've already lost the kind of don't do evil mantra, right? But they need to basically recodify their culture in a way, because they're living in a little bit of a half pregnant state. And I think that's also causing a lot of this mix up
from
every angle.
Yeah, every angle. Yeah. I mean, there's, being, called a monopoly and just a bunch of issues, the pressure that they're getting, the social pressure they're getting is both from consumers and from employees.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's going to be interesting. Look, I think that we're going to be talking about Google quite a bit, I think for the rest of the year on a number of different issues. This specific topic, to your point, is going to be really curious to see if this is that initial light that sort of lights the fire to some extent around these other organizations. Because if Alphabet can't figure it out or how to address it, I think it'd be much harder for the other companies.
If I was CEO of Google, a job I do not aspire to, I can only imagine what Sundar Pichai what his sleeping hours must be. But I would want to see the platform that this union represents, kind of understand that. To me, it's very unclear what that is. I'm not opposed to it given their stated objectives to the extent I could find stated objectives, but it's just very unclear. And I do think that there's pretty significant implications to Google and to the industry for this kind of thing, particularly in the area of you know, what we talked about earlier, right? More bureaucracy, kind of right. like division or some cultural upheaval. So you got to be very, very clear and understand the platform to be able to like deal with it within Google and outside of Google.
Yeah, but I think in terms of the approach is, A, you can't ignore them. And I think if you want to have this go away in any way whatsoever, then you have to aggressively try to address the concerns of your employees that are not yet on board with this union. Because you're still only talking about 400 employees yeah. that are part of this union. But if you don't address the bigger issues that everyone else does agree with, because even in the article they were talking about it, some folks were not on board with being part of this union, and in part because they felt that their previous efforts of protest were being dismissed by, remember, because this is sort of associated with that broader Communication Workers of America union, right? So there's internal some misalignment in terms of whether they want to be involved with this. But I think if you're Google, like, you have to proactively address the broader concerns that your employee base is having. I think you have to find a way, especially in this case with Timnit, you know, Gerber, to address that somehow. I don't know if bringing her back is even an option anymore.
That definitely lit a wick. There's no question.
Yeah. So there is some fires that they have to put out first.
I just wonder if there's anything that ultimately they can do to avoid some variation of this at all times. In other words, they've gotten so big. They're so, you know, just full of money.
And
it's just like, at some point, even if they capitulate or if they set up programs, it's just, they're an easy target. When companies get this big and they start getting that reputation, there's going to be people trying to hit them from all sides. And that's just that's just a challenge that they actually have. But, you know, interesting story. We'll see kind of where it goes. We'll track it. But Google is going to be a big topic of our conversations for 2021 and beyond. Should we move to Courage or Cringe?
Let's do it.
All right. Very cool. First Courage or Cringe of the season. A wide variety of items here, kind of all over the place. Let's start with the guy with the most colorful name in sports broadcasting, Booger McFarland.
So first the background, right? So recently the Washington football team, remember, this is another one of the topics that we sort of touched about before.
That's right.
Previously known as the Redskins, released Dwayne Haskins, which was a pretty shocking decision considering that it used a first round draft pick on the Ohio State quarterback just last year, right? So only a year in the league, first round draft pick, you know, those are expensive picks to be putting out. And is already a bust and has been released, which is, you know, that's not common. That's a big deal.
He also has some context, right? He also broke COVID protocol. He ended up going to a strip club.
He had issues
pretty much
all the stuff off the field. Yeah. This is like the guy.
This was not like just he didn't perform.
So we're not really here to talk about him getting released. I think he got released for a number of reasons, a number of which sound pretty good reasons. But the reason why this falls on the Courage or Cringe is more about the actual conversation around his release, right? So amid a roundtable discussion about, you know, Dwayne Haskins on Monday Night Countdown, which is a show before Monday Night Football, Booger McFarland, which, once again, love the name, who's both a commentator and an ex-NFL player.
And by the way, at 6'1", 300 pounds, you're not going to tell him his name is funny sounding.
You're going to say that Mr. Booger?
Mr. Booger.
Exactly, right?
Former defensive end, too, for the Buccaneers.
For the Buccaneers, that's right. So he delivered a pretty questionable take on the quarterback bus, right? So, and I quote, he mentioned, oftentimes young players, especially, I'm going to go ahead, especially young African-American players, because they make up 70% of this league, they come into this league and ask themselves the wrong thing. They come into the league saying, not how can I be a better player? They don't say, how can I be a better teammate? They don't say, how can I be a better person? How can I get my organization over the hump? Here's what they come in saying. They come in saying, how can I build my brand better? How can I build my social media following better? How can I work on Instagram and show everybody that I'm ready to go? But when I get to the game, I don't perform. You know, Dwayne Haskins, unfortunately, is not the first case that I've seen like this, right? And he goes on to compare it to other folks. And it won't be the last. And it bothers me because a lot of it is the young African-American players. They come in, they don't like it. They don't take it as a business. It's still a game to them. I saw a quarterback do it. I saw Jamarcus Russell do it, which, by the way, famously was a massive bust, who was the number one draft pick. They gave him $40 million and he threw it down the damn drain because he didn't take it seriously. So he was the number one draft pick for the Raiders coming out of LSU, I think is what it was, right?
Yeah.
So basically he kind of puts this whole thing on him, not just on him, but really as representative of African-American players in general and specifically, of course, quarterbacks. Now, I think the part where many people sort of had issue with this immediately, and I'll let you, of course, respond to this, is that what he doesn't actually talk about is many of the now white player, especially quarterbacks, who had a similar kind of bust. Maybe not as quick as a year into their...
Johnny Manziel.
Johnny Manziel's probably the first one that will pop up, which is one of the more recent ones. Ryan Leaf was a Ryan pretty Leaf. Famous one from, you know, back in the day. Paxton Lynch, Jake Locker. No, there's a number of other quarterback busts who basically have had similar outcomes, maybe not as quickly as this case, but... You know, to put it all as African American players, I think is what really raised a lot of red flags. So, what was your take when you saw this commentary?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
By the way, it's a bunch of things here, right? There's the whole comment around putting around African American players. That's sort of point one. Point two is this whole notion about whether these players, when they come in, should be thinking about building their brand or being better or focusing on play first and foremost. And there's a lot of debate there as well. So, whichever one you want to take
there's
on first.
There's such a confluence of things, though, in his statement, some of which I think undermined what he was trying to say.
I agree with that already.
And let me break it down a few of them. Number one is he made a comment at the beginning about, he says, I'm going to go there about the African-American players. And then he said, he qualifies it. He goes, because they're 70% of the league. So it seemed at that moment that he was beginning to appeal to the fact that I want to address something that is the case because this is the majority of the people. Like, and so I started listening from that standpoint. But then he made other points that kind of took him away from this majority kind of stance.
Then he
kind of
brought it back in.
The other thing that was a bit of a confluence was when he said they don't take it seriously, these black players in particular. But I don't know if at that point he was talking only of black players. He was saying specifically the black players. But that they don't take it seriously. They don't treat it like a business. And then he goes on and gives an example of what they do treat it as. Let's work on my brand. Let's work on whatever. Well, that is part of the business, right? So I think what he was trying to say is maybe they don't take the athletic part seriously, but he kept saying business, this is a business, this is a business. I think coming in and talking about my brand, the value of my franchise, longevity, my endorsements, what investments can I make, that is part of the business. Now, I think you might not like it.
Yeah, by business, I think he meant specifically the business of the team. Right.
Right.
As it relates to the team. Right. Which is separate than your personal brand, your personal business and anything you do outside of the field.
Right. And for the record, in case somebody's listening and just not a football fan or follows any Monday Night Football, Booger McFarland is black. Right. So just to be clear.
Right.
And so that gives you a little bit of color to the context.
I mean, with that name, you really couldn't know what he was.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't even know where the nickname came from. But anyway, my point was there's a confluence of different things. Where it made it hard for me to try to understand what point he was making. And it was only at the very end when he started talking more about this, like he got a little bit animated, you know, talking about some of the previous busts and that they come in and they flush their stuff down the drain and blah, that it was clear to me, at least the way I think, that he was making a point that there was a cultural thing. To me, it's what it sounded like, that people come in and they're more worried about how much money and how much fame and how much prosperity and how much whatever, rather than can I be a really solid athlete? And on that side, I agree with him because my boys both play football and they play, even though they are not D1 prospects in high school, they play with people who are D1 prospects. And I have plenty of experience with D1 bound athletes in high school, not so much in college, but in high school and their families. And there is a not insignificant contingent that very much even from an early age is definitely talking about like endorsements and shoe deals and content and social. And this is a means to get to that, right? So that is something. Now, we can debate whether or not that's right or wrong. To say it doesn't exist to me is just not according with reality. Whether or not it's a majority of players, I don't know. Right. And it does not just impact black players. It impacts a lot of players in general. But it is something that I've seen that does exist among people, you know, in the football world. It just does, this idea of being focused on that. So ultimately, it was hard for me. I think all in all, I fell on courage on this one. And the reason for that was just simply because he was stating a truth that is unpopular to say. He did it inelegantly, and he did it in a way that talked about a variety of things, in some cases undermining his argument. But the core issue about people come into this league and they're more focused on brands and endorsements and things like that and less about playing the game and laying some of that responsibility on the majority of the players who happen to be black is a tough thing to say. And I think for that, I ultimately came down on courage, although it was by a slim margin. You?
I'm the complete opposite. So this is total, total cringe. And the reason for that is this reminds me of what, unfortunately, many diverse people have to deal with. is that their individual actions many times are taken as a reflection to their entire race, ethnicity, group that is associated. And it's, I think this is really, really unfair, mm-hmm. right? Now, the fact that you have, you know, a lot of players into his argument that he thinks that focus more on their individual brand versus a play, that, sure, I don't disagree with that. By the way, I think the whole industry has shifted in that direction, because now we're talking about players who have social brands as, you know, high school, even before that, sure. right? So that's already a much bigger trend that's across all players who play, regardless of race, right?
Look at Zion. Zion's Instagram handle was bigger than for sure. Jordan, I think, when he was in high school.
Yeah, you have some of the, yeah, and a lot of these
or
kids.
Or LeBron.
Exactly. And these are all people that are working on their personal brand. Now, they happen to be good and play really well, and it doesn't seem to affect their actual play, so therefore no one has a problem with it. But that's a sort of a separate issue. To me, pinning this directly on African-American players.
Only do you think that's what he was doing, though? Or do you think he just misspoke?
I think if he only said it once, I would say he wasn't. But the fact that he kind of came back and doubled down on it again.
But just
the part where I had an issue with it.
But just on raw numbers, if you're talking about 70% of the pool of people happen to be African-American, aren't you, by extension, if you say... like this group talking 70% about African Americans?
No, because then you're saying that the 30% that are not doing this, and that's just not the case. That's just not true. If you think about a lot of the players that we talked about, Johnny Manziel, who the guy loved to party, personal
for sure,
massive personal brand,
sure.
He's not black. He was doing it as well. We have a lot of these other players that are also doing this.
Because the
proportion of players is majority African American. The way that he's framing it, it makes it sound like it's only that group of players who have this problem that basically prioritize personal brand higher than their actual professional yeah. performance. And that's what I have issue with.
I hear that 100%. That's where I think you and I are not seeing the same thing, because what I saw was him say, especially for the African-American players, because they're the majority. And if you're 7 out of 10 people, then it's going to apply at a greater degree because there's just more of them. So I don't think he was saying only. I think he was saying especially them. And that's where maybe I just see it differently.
But to me, when I hear that especially is providing a special focus on African-American players as having a bigger problem with it, as opposed
to... Right, but right, not related to the fact that they're 70% is what you're saying.
Correct, right?
See, that's how I read it. I read it because it's their 70%.
Well, because he says that, but then he goes back and brings it again about being African-American players, right? So that's what I think... Look, that's my issue. That's the biggest issue that I have with his comments, mm-hmm. right? I'm in no way justifying this kid that burned out so quickly and that obviously prioritized a lot of things in front of his actual performance, right? But this notion that players shouldn't build, I guess the other question of this conversation is like, should players try to build their own personal brand while trying to make it in the league? I have a hard time making an argument to a player that is, by the way, plays in the NFL, which is, as most people say, is not for long, that may be playing for 3-4 years, right? And has to figure out a way to make the majority of their money that they're probably ever going to make in those 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't set themselves up correctly, they may end up being broke. Many of them don't even finish college, sure. right? They have a bunch of issues that are there. Could have a bunch of medical problems after playing. Not to try to find a way to build personal brand or to plant seeds that they can later on be able to, develop from there and create opportunity. So I have a hard time making an argument. I understand his point that if you do that at the expense of actually playing, then you're doing yourself
a disservice
because you're not going to get playing time. You're going to get bounced from the league right away. And then all this work that you're trying to do to leverage that moment in time where you have the most popularity is gonna go away. I get that point. So if it was about that, I understand. But I did have the reason why I come hard on cringe is that I really don't like the way they laid it on black players. And really, frankly, what it reminded me of is what I was saying, which is this notion that if, you know, when Johnny Manziel came out and say, you know, these white quarterbacks, you can't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these white quarterbacks from the Big Ten leagues, you cannot trust those guys because mm-hmm. they're not going to deliver. Like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. What do you mean? Mm-hmm. Because Johnny Manziel is that, right? Or yeah, these Heisman Trophy winners, you can't trust those guys because they're all bust.
So what do you So what do you think? So it's a cringe, but I'm just curious. What do you think the motivation is? Because some people, I'm sure, if they haven't already, will eventually call Booger McFarland a racist, even though he's black.
Yeah, but I don't think it needs to be called a racist. I just think that, I mean, I feel that in this case, maybe he feels because he himself is black that he's in a special position to be able to call out his own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his way, to your point, like, you know, people that are, you know, they're older players that are maybe have a little bit outdated way of thinking, because in his way of thinking, I could see it already, which is you come in, you shut up, you work hard, you earn your spot, you do that first. And after you're done with all of that, then maybe you look at doing something else. OK, that makes sense. When you were, you know, playing in the late 90s, when there was no social media, where everything was about, like, just your performance on Sundays or Thursdays, whatever, mm-hmm. if it was Thursday afternoon. Like, that makes sense at that time. It doesn't quite make sense now. Because many, many times, the reason why some of these guys are getting the contracts they're getting is because they already have the kind of following, that kind of brand, to your comment about Zion. And even like the LeBar, the Ball brothers and all those guys, right? They're at the other extreme, but they somehow figured out to be able to leverage that pretty well and give them, you know, quite a bit of success. Now, it happens that two out of three players can actually play, or two out of three brothers can actually play. One is not very good, but that's why I have a hard time. I can understand that argument. I just did not like him laying it that way.
Okay, fair enough.
With African American players,
fair enough. Okay, so we immediately start off 2021 with complete disagreement.
Complete disagreement.
All right, so now we're moving far afield from the gridiron over to maybe a place who could benefit from playing a game of Smash Mouth football, Silicon Valley. And the folks over at Coinbase got themselves into some trouble. What's that about?
Yeah, so also from the in New York Times. So in data recently obtained by New York Times, it indicated that women at Coinbase were paid an average of $13,000 or 8% less than men at comparable jobs and ranks within the company, right? So according to their analysis and figures, which included pay details for most Coinbase roughly 830 employees from the end of 2018. Now, what gets even worse when we look at it by different levels of roles, at certain manager levels, women were paid even as much as 20% less than the men in the organization. The picture was also unequal for the 16 salary black employees in the data. By the way, hard pause on that comment. You have 16 black employees out of 830.
It's 3%.
Which is,
yeah,
and I was, and like, I don't even care how much they're underpaid. To some extent, they're like, you have 16 employees that are black. Like,
right.
Guys, we can do better.
And
we can do better.
It's been that way for like 3 or 4 years, apparently.
And they were paid, and for them, they were paid $11,500 or 7% less than all other employees in similar jobs, right?
Mm-hmm. Irrespective of gender in that case with the black.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. So there's no gender issue there. Just
right.
And, you know, some of the history there, numerous black employees at Coinbase had recently publicly complained about discrimination they face at the company. And then also several women who work at Coinbase had also complained internally about how they were hired, paid, and promoted according to the company documents, and five employees with knowledge of the complaints. What was interesting in looking at this is that there was some data they shared what actually compared some of that pay disparity at Coinbase, and that it was actually worse than the tech industry overall, because as we've covered in this podcast before, is that Silicon Valley in general has a problem as it relates to diversity representation and also like having, you know, equal pay for some of these folks, right? So when you look at roles that were adjusted for comparable jobs at Coinbase, they were minus 8% in terms of their disparity in paying women versus Google at minus 0.4, and the industry average is minus 0.1. So it's below, but, you know, fairly a parity. Mm-hmm. When it's not adjusted for comparable jobs, Coinbase was at minus 18 versus minus 14 for Google and minus 15 for industry average. And the reason you see such a big difference is just that in certain roles, there's just very little, you know, representation of women, especially for the higher paying roles.
Mm-hmm.
And look, their CEO responded, their head of people operation responded, and all the things that they've done. But when you actually look at the actual internal figures, right, it looks like the diversity, the company's diversity has not really changed since 2018. In late 2019, the percentage of female and black employees was 33% for female and then 3% for black employees, mm-hmm. which was about the same as it was in 2018. So this is a case, you know, in how we started the podcast where, like, if diversity is in any way important, and for many of these companies, including this one who, you know, claims to make a number change in terms of some of their programs, how they look at compensation, et cetera, it certainly doesn't look reflective from the actual data itself.
Yeah, I think, you know, to be a bit cynical, I think the idea of diversity is a, kind of a means to an end and a little bit of a PR thing for a lot of these companies. I'm not saying that they don't have some intent to do better, but I think that they look at it principally for the messaging value that it brings or that it takes away. And I think until we get rid of that and have the folks start actually looking at the value and benefit of bringing a variety of different folks with different experiences into these organizations, nothing's going to happen because they're kind of wrapped up in the messaging of what this is or isn't. That to me is like the biggest problem here. Now, in their defense, and just to kind of start with the end in mind, this is a cringe for me, but just in their defense, the numbers that you just cited, which compared their stats to Google and Oracle, in the Google and Oracle cases, those numbers actually controlled for things like experience and education. And in the Coinbase one, we don't have those stats, right?
Right.
So yeah, it could be possible that you could be, let's call it manager one, level one in one organization and manager level one at Coinbase, but manager level one at the other organization, you've got a four-year degree and in the other one you don't. And that's why you're getting paid a little bit more money. So let's kind of, you know, let's be clear about that because there could be some additional disparity. But but overall, I think that the history or the kind of pattern of things that has happened here, coupled with one interesting stat that frankly was like, to me, when I read it, I was like, okay, this is reason alone for this thing to be a cringe, was what the deciding factor was for me. So their past history, the stats that are shown here, the discrepancy between the industry, even though I'm taking into account that they're not necessarily apples to apples, and this last fact, and that is a quote from the article that said that more than 5% of the company, 60 some odd employees, quit literally months ago, this fall, literally months ago, after the CEO put in place a policy that restricted employees from discussing politics and social issues at work. Like literally said, you can't have those conversations.
Right.
5% of the company quit.
Yeah.
To me, that's enough of a reason to give this. I mean, it's a different subject, but it kind of shows you a little bit about what the kind of culture might be like internally that you're trying to kind of govern and mandate that level
right?
of communication.
Because when you think about this story relative to what we were just talking about, which is Google, and then the move to start unionizing, you can see how a lot of these companies are going to get, like right now, just sort of getting called out by individuals and some of this data getting leaked, but you're going to start seeing probably a move to much more unionization. In this case, even looking at pay potentially, right? And if you're a CEO and you're making that kind of policy announcement, like what are you thinking? Like, first of all, know that you're running a tech startup where even if you personally feel that way, fine, but you're just not operating that kind of environment with people that are highly skilled, highly mobile in terms of different kinds of, you know, being able to work for different kinds of companies. I mean, it's just, at some point, I think these kind of things has to go to board level, especially for companies like this one who are trying to go public. I think they're trying to go public, if I remember correctly.
What percentage of the population do you think knows what the hell Coinbase is or what they do?
A very small percentage. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I think a very small percentage. But I think that's where this has to, you know, starts to go into like boards getting involved,
sure,
and making some real, you know, addressing some of these real changes here. Because if you're looking at what's going on in Google, and you know you have this kind of issues and disparities in your company, like that's a big problem. So I was with you. I was very cringe on this one for a whole set of reasons.
They have a 1 out of 5 rating on Glassdoor, by the way, for D&I.
And it's, yeah, I mean, and you're talking about, once again, they're going to be trying to, as they grow, they're going to try to bring more high-skilled employees that have a lot of mobility in terms of where they can work. It's going to be a problem for them. So I think for their own sake, they got to figure out a way to address some of these issues, or it's going to come back and bite them in the butt.
Interesting. So you're a cringe.
Yes.
500. Okay. We're batting 500.
Yeah, we're back at 500.
All right. Let's see how we round it out. This one, I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Brand new story. This is breaking literally as we were putting the show together today. Folks are going to hear this on the 6th, but we're recording the day before. And this story just broke about Kamala Harris. And well, you tell the background.
Yeah,
and we can kind of get into it.
Kamala Harris repeatedly told a freedom story.
Freedom.
That is now facing plagiarism accusations. So, look, there was an L interview that she did that was published actually in October 2020. So the story, the root of the story is actually not new, right? So that was published in October 2020, where Vice President-elect Kamala Harris recalled accompanying her parents to marches as a toddler in a stroller. The author,
civil rights marches.
Correct, yeah. So the author of the story, Ashley Ford, she wrote, Senator Kamala Harris started her life's work young. She laughs from her gut, the way you would with family, and she remembers being wheeled through an Oakland, California civil rights march in a stroller with no straps with her parents and her uncle. At some point, she fell from the stroller, and the adults caught up in the rapture of protests just kept on marching. By the time they noticed little Kamala was gone and doubled back, she was understandably upset. Now, Kamala recalled, my mother tells a story about how I'm fussing. And she's like, baby, what do you want? What do you need? And I just looked at her and I said, freedom. Right. So very cute story. Mm-hmm. Very nice. What she says is right. Now, by the way, this story or version of the story have been shared previously by the VP elect. And one in her 2010 book.
Yeah, she published it.
She published it called Smart on Crime. And then again in her 2019 book called The Truth We Hold, An American Journey. Right. So, however, the reason why this sort of came up now, and this is the breaking story part of it, is after that interview sort of resurfaced on Monday, there was some Twitter users and also Andre Domasi, which is the contributor editor for the Canadian publication Maclean's, noted that Harris' story resembled one told by Dr. Martin Luther King in a 1965 interview published in Playboy. Now, according to that, to that article from Playboy,
in 1965 article.
Yeah, correct, right? And for those of you, by the way, they may remember this, like in Playboy, actually, they did a lot of these kind
they
of
did
interviews.
Like long form journalistic, yeah,
and they were very like pro diversity, bringing up some of these like real issues that were really happening at the time. I know they had, I think I want to say they had Malcolm X on one. They had Martin Luther King as well. I mean, it was really interesting because you don't necessarily associate that with Playboy. But
by the way, total aside, but that's why the old joke about Playboy was that guys would say, well, you know, I read it for the articles.
Right, because there was just the real articles.
Even today, though, you hear that and it's like, that makes absolutely no sense even as a joke. But if you go back 40 years, it would have been funny to say, well, there actually are good articles in there's a
great like docu-series. Mm-hmm. It's docu-scripted, kind of a combination, right? On Hugh Hefner. I think it's called Playboy, an American icon or American entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I want to say
on what platform?
I want to say it's Amazon Prime. I want to mm-hmm. say great, great documentary. It talks mm-hmm. about how he started the company, right, and how he built it out, and some of the things that he did specifically to support a lot of the activism that was going on at the time. So they talk about some of these interviews that we're doing and highlighting African American jazz players, even at the protests of many of the stations that were carrying some of the programming. It's really interesting. So for those of you who haven't seen it, I will say see it.
Okay.
But anyway, going back to what the article said, in that interview that Dr. King gave, he said, I will never forget a moment in Birmingham when a white policeman accosted a little Negro girl, 7 or 8 years old, who was walking in a demonstration with her mother. What do you want? The policeman asked her gruffly. And the little girl looked at him straight in the eye and answered, feed him, right? She couldn't even pronounce it, but she knew it was beautiful, right? So when you hear that story versus the Kamala, story, of course, there's a lot of similarities to it, right? The little girl, you know, being sort of asked, and in this case, you know, replaced the police officer by her mom. But the main sort of essence of the story feels very, very similar. So, of course, when this happened, you know, there was some immediate response / rage, right, on social
/rage.
Well, you know, there was, right?
When is there not social? When is there not /rage?
There was a lot of, you know, response that we saw primarily in some right leaning media, of course.
Well, that's who broke it, though. We just literally like 20 minutes ago started seeing like more everybody pick it up, but it was broken by the conservative media.
And there was, you know, also, of course, some quick comparisons to President-elect Biden's own plagiarism accusations from 1987, right? Mm. So then Senator Biden, who was running at the time for the Democratic Party's nomination, he gave a speech that was very close or bore resemblance to one delivered that same year by the head of the British Labour Party, Neil Kinnock, who and he got a lot of flack for that.
That one was a bit more clear-cut.
That was a big controversy at the time because it definitely felt very, very similar. Now, you know, then Senator Biden ended up dropping out of the Democratic Party nomination. And it was like one of the tragedies that happened to him. I forget what exactly was.
Yeah,
the
reason he dropped. His wife
is that when his wife passed away? Yeah. So he ended up dropping off. But nevertheless, there's these, you know, comparisons, of course, being made there.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly came the memes. And oh, I love
I saw one in your notes. It was hysterical.
Hilarious. So there's, of course, like Braveheart memes, right, where, you know, when he shouts the whole freedom, right, but it was with the hashtag freedom with the W, which is hilarious. But the best one was the one from The Office. Now there's a very famous scene in The Office where Michael Scott is talking and he has this behind the backboard that says, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, and then it has a small font, you know, Wayne Gretzky, and then a much bigger font, Michael Scott, and then they added an even like bigger font, Kamala Harris, and has a picture of Kamala Harris. Like, that's great. I mean, just on the meme alone, I could not stop laughing. So anyways,
you gotta be an Office fan, but I
enjoyed,
it's hysterical.
I enjoyed the story for that reason. But
all right, you wanna go first? By the way, what are we actually courage or cringing? The story or the accusation? What is it exactly? Probably the accusation, right?
I guess it has to be the accusation.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. I can do that. I can work with that. Do you want me to go first?
Or
you
sure. Cause I'm literally still debating. So, okay, so if I hear your take, it may change my mind.
Okay. All right. So the accusation of her plagiarizing, based on what I understand right now and all the information that we've talked about, if I had to courage or cringe that, I would say it's a cringe. Here's why. I actually don't believe necessarily that this story actually happened in Kamala's youth, only because I find her extraordinarily inauthentic and very opportunistic. So I think that it's more likely that it's a conflation of things. So number one is, I don't believe that it's happened exactly as she said, but that's beside the point. The fact that something similar could have happened is much more likely than this is a straight up plagiaristic thing, right? Mm-hmm. I can imagine her mom maybe reading that story of MLK or hearing about it or something, and then maybe ascribing it to her. I can also imagine her saying something similar and just, you know, being the case that she did say freedom at some point, and it just happened that, you know, it seems she was younger. Right. The girl in the MLK story was 7 years old. Kamala is being strolled around in a baby stroller. So some of the things don't match, but
right.
But I think more likely than not, it was a conflation of stories. Mm. And but I think it's been innocently appropriated to her. I don't think it's a malicious thing. I do think she's used it for knock-on effect wherever she's used for it, because sure. It automatically yeah. gets like a, oh, that's so amazing.
That's so great.
You've been such a freedom fighter from the very beginning, right? So so it's very expedient for her to use it. But nevertheless, the accusation of plagiarism on her part, where I don't know of evidence of her being any plagiarism allegations in her past, Biden for sure, yes, have been made before. So I think the sum of all of that is very flimsy evidence.
Yeah.
And so to me, the accusation seems like it's a bit of a, you know, straw grasp and maybe a way to kind of just mess with her. You know what I mean? So for me, I give it a cringe just on the evidence that I've found.
Yeah. And I was, you know, maybe giving a little bit more benefit of the doubt to these guys that were bringing it up, which is why I was debating about it a little bit more maybe than I typically would. But I'm with you on also saying that it's cringe. And the reason I say that is that, look, I'm agreeing with you as well. When I hear that story, I don't 100% believe that it happened exactly as she describes it. This feels to me like a romanticized version of something that happened.
Yeah.
Right. Like the one thing that we do know is that her parents were activists. They were, I'm sure, in some of the marches. Do I believe that they took her to some of the marches? Yeah. Do I believe that maybe some of the cases, you know, something happened where she, you know, they lost her for a quick second? I could see that as well. Is it exactly how she describes it here? Probably not. Having said that, the fact that she's already said it multiple times, has it in multiple books, like this romanticized version or this version of a story, she, I think, believes it enough to actually be okay saying it over and over again. So
it's become true. It's like a folk tale.
Yeah, so
kind of
it's
thing.
Like, so I have a hard time thinking that it's really directly trying to plagiarize from the story that Martin Luther King obviously shared in this interview. So that's why I'm with you at the same time. Having said that, I still love the memes. Like, frankly, the memes alone made it worthwhile. That Office meme.
Hysterical, classic.
I love it.
Maybe the meme of 2021 so far.
It may be. So, you know, typically, because of my own sort of political biases, I tend to like look at more of the liberal memes than the conservative. But this one, I got to give them credit. Whoever did this one, they nailed it. So
the right
I love
does
it.
Meme pretty well. That's one of the things they do well. Okay, so then we're 60, the dreaded 66% then, which is good. I'll take that.
Not bad.
I'll take that to open up the year. Very good. Any parting words on this episode, our first of 2021?
I guess the only thing is, like, look, we didn't actually talk about this at all, but today on January 5th, which is when we're recording this, right now 7 o'clock at night, is actually when we're having the Senate runoff elections in Georgia.
Oh, in Georgia. That's right.
So it's really interesting what's going to happen in the next couple of days. The reason we didn't really want to talk about it, because literally happening as we're speaking, and look, the way the last election happened, we may not know the results for another week or more than that. So we'll see how that goes. And then tomorrow is going to be the certification of the Electoral College, right? That happens in Congress. And that's the one that I'm very curious to see what happens. Ultimately, I don't think the outcome changes in any way whatsoever. But I guess the only thing, my only parting words is I really hope this is the last step, literally the last step, for us to be able to start the process moving forward, right? Because there's been so much drama. There was the whole drama around this, which I also found pretty hilarious, this call that, that President Trump had with...
Oh, that's next week's show. Come on, don't ruin
it.
Yeah,
so...
No, I'm just kidding.
That just happened.
With the Secretary of State for Georgia.
Secretary of State, thank you. Thank you. Which was hilarious. But I just hope that we're at a point now where we are starting to move forward. I think what happens today, what happens tomorrow will be really, really interesting. And I'm frankly looking forward...
Well, what happens today on the runoff and what happens tomorrow when Congress counts the electoral votes? Because that's the other big thing that happens.
Yeah,
there's
going to
be a lot of news.
Yeah. So I'm sure we'll talk about it more next week, but... Yeah, my only word, it's not even a word of wisdom. I'm just like hopeful that we're at the last stages of this transition in this political time that hopefully, you know, sets us to a little better path of less, you know, conflict between each other. We can start moving forward together as a country.
I love it. Very good. My only parting words are, you know, maybe just a little reminder and inspiration for everybody based on my own little affirmations of courage, clarity, and communication. I think that those are good things for maybe all of us to bring to bear on 2021, especially the clarity and communication part. I think we need to, you know, continue to have conversations and dialogue, and that's a good thing. So my hope is 2021 is that year of bringing, yes, this thing being over, but also being the birth of conversations around topics that we may or may not agree with, but doing it in a way that's respectful. And I think that's a good thing. That'll help all of us across the board. That's my hope. As we get started.
Love it.
Cool. All right. Well, that's a wrap for episode 1 of 2021. Thank you. See us next week on another episode of TDR. If you enjoyed this episode of the Diversity Remix, please remember, first of all, to subscribe and help us to spread the word. Tell your friends, family, coworkers, and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your listening fix. And lastly, please remember to stop by blackbrown.us, the creator of this podcast, and take a look at our work and our approach at the intersection of diversity and business. The Diversity Remix is produced by Leo Gomez, with production services by Jose Manuel Durquidi and Luis Diego Carranza and our friends at Juan Diego Network. The Diversity Remix is a production of Black Brown.